Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we got two super good hours for you. Our good friend Jimmy Akin is here both hours today, which is very exciting. I always like it when we get a couple hours in together on a Thursday. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Hello, Jimmy.
Hey there.
How are you?
I always like these two-hour things, too. It feels substantial, you know.
Yeah.
These days, for me, an hour of radio goes by like that.
I know.
Yeah,
I know, and it does actually go by like that. And then sometimes too, I notice that there'll be a really good question that'll come in at the end of the hour, and then you're like, I can't answer that one. I have to leave that one for Father Trigilio or who's ever on the second hour. You'll have a chance to really build up a head of steam this afternoon.
Sure.
It's open forum for those of you who have an interest in calling in. 888-318-7884 is our number. Open forum means you can call about any religious question. If you have particular questions about the Catholic faith that either you would like explained to you or you would like help explaining to someone else, this is a perfect day for you. 888-318-7884. If you're not Catholic, you can call. If you're Catholic, you can call. Everybody's welcome to call. 888-31-TRUTH is that number.
And right now, I think lines are open because I can see our call screener is swishing back and forth in his chair and not call screening. So that means there must not be any calls.
Yeah, it could also possibly mean that he has gone into a trance again. That occasionally happens with Tom. No, that doesn't happen with Tom.
Okay.
Not to my knowledge. Jimmy.
Yeah.
We are approaching Midsummer's Eve or
mid- yeah, sure.
This is something I never understood until recently. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. I think it's probably you that explained it to me.
Mm.
What we consider the first day of summer,
mm-hmm.
in the Middle Ages, they thought of that as midsummer.
Yeah.
Or they would call it midsummer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why?
Well, you may have noticed the seasons don't seem tied really well to the equinoxes and solstices. It starts to feel like summer way before the summer solstice.
Oh, yeah.
And it starts to feel like spring way before the vernal equinox, usually. And it depends on the part of the world you're in. But really, the equinoxes and solstices are kind of in the mid-range of the seasons in terms of temperature and things that are going on in nature.
Right.
And that's because of what the solstices and equinoxes are. The solstices are where there's the most or the least daylight.
Oh, yeah.
And so and the equinoxes are where the day and night are equal. But if you consider the solstices, if you're in a period where there's the most night, it's going to tend to be cold there. But you've been building up to that most night state for a while. And so the cold has been coming for a while. And hangs out for a while. And so the solstices, like the equinoxes, are kind of in the middle of the temperature seasons.
Did they attach religious significance to midsummer?
Depends on whose religion you're talking about.
Well, Christians, for example, was there?
Not in particular. The church's calendar has some impact from natural things, including the spring equinox, which is used to determine the time of Easter because of Passover.
Yep.
Because the Jewish people used a lunar calendar. Or at least partially lunar, and that's actually where we originally get our word month from moon, because months are approximately the length of one cycle of the moon.
Yeah.
But for the most part, the Christian calendar isn't determined by the Earth's orbit in that way.
I gotcha. But this I just need to clear up before we move on from our discussion of midsummer, and then I will get to the callers. Shakespeare's
Midsummer Night's Dream.
That's in June. Mm-hmm. I always thought to me, but mm-hmm. because he would have gone by the idea that what we call the first day of summer is actually midsummer.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So June 20th or 21st.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I was in that play once.
Were you?
Yeah, I was.
Were you Puckish?
I was not Puck. I played one of the mechanicals.
Oh, very good. It's a great play. Mm-hmm. It's a great play. I think one of the greatest.
Oh, what fools these mortals be.
I often think that people think that the dramas and the tragedies are greater art because we just like – it just makes us feel important to do drama and tragedy. But sometimes the comedies are the greatest
Comedy
art.
Is awesome.
Yeah.
It's also hard.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Well, we can go to calls. We already got.
Let's do it.
We got Lewis on the line from Brooklyn, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Lewis, thanks for downloading the Catholic Answers app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Sure, thank you. So I wanted to know what should I do if I'm noticing in my parish that there has been abuses in the Mass where they're pretty much taking out any reference to God being male. Mm. Where, like, so instead of saying his holy will, they'll just say, you know, God's holy will. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed other things, too, and this is pretty much every weekend, I could say. So I just wanted to know, is there anything I can do am I allowed to not participate in those particular parts where I see it being altered, basically?
Well, so it's a complex question. Set of questions, actually, that you're asking. And I have a whole book on the subject. It's currently available in ebook form. It's called Mass Revision, and it goes into all these questions. It even has a whole chapter on how to deal with liturgical abuses when you encounter them. But I'd say a few things at the moment. One is it's important to be clear about what is a liturgical abuse versus what's not. In the strict sense, a liturgical abuse is a deviation from something that the church has said must happen in the liturgy. If a priest is altering the text of, say, the Eucharistic prayer, that is a liturgical abuse. But if he's preaching a homily and just avoiding the word him for God, that's annoying and is an undue politicization of the Mass, and he shouldn't be doing that. But it's not a liturgical abuse in the strict sense. So we need to be clear about what is and is not an abuse. Also, some things that we may or may not like may not be abuses at all. The church has considerable flexibility built into the Mass and how particular things can go. And so there are things that you may like or may not like that actually aren't abuses at all. And in fact, that's why I wrote the book, was to help provide clarity on a lot of that. In terms of what to do when they happen, there are things you can do. You need to, in the first place, establish that an abuse is occurring. And then in keeping with the principle that Jesus articulates in Matthew 18, where you try to solve problems on the lowest level first, you want to then go to the person who's committing the abuse and talk to them about it. You don't immediately leap over that person's head. People don't like it when someone leaps over their head. You wouldn't like it if someone leapt over your head and went straight to your boss. And so per keeping with the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, you need to start with the lowest level and try to solve the problem there first. If in doing that, you want to be as winning as you can. You want to obtain the best hearing for your case as you can. And that means not going into the situation and being hostile as your first line of recourse. You need to go in and be as winning and persuasive as you can. One way of doing that, in the case of this pronoun trouble, if you wanted to bite off that challenge, it would be to say, you know, so-and-so, who's ever doing it, whether it's the priest or somebody else, this injects gender politics into the Mass, and it interferes with my ability to go with the flow in the Mass. It pops me right out of the worship and gets me not thinking about God, but thinking about these other issues instead, these, you know, pronoun issues. And it's hindering my ability to relate to God in Mass. And I suspect that's the case for quite a number of people in the congregation. They may not say it, but this isn't the standard use of English. And it's not the standard form of these prayers that people are familiar with. And having that kind of variation is just going to pop people out of the spirit of worship and make them start thinking about this, whether they say so or not. So it's understandable that you want to respect women today and so forth. That's great. And there are other ways you can do that. But if you do it here in this way, it's going to be a hindrance to people's devotion rather than a help. And so framing it in those terms is going to tend to get a better reception. Now, it may not change his mind, but it's going to tend to get a better reception than starting with thunderous denunciations. If you determine that if you don't get satisfaction at the lowest level, and then you need to make a determination, do I escalate? Do I go up from there? And it's certainly possible to do that. You also may look at the situation and conclude, you know, there are other things I need to devote my time and energy to. A particular issue in a parish does not always mean I need to take action about it. Just because there's a problem somewhere doesn't mean that I need to be the one to fix it. If we tried to implement the principle of any time there's ever a problem anywhere, I have to step in to fix it, we would never accomplish anything because we'd waste all our time in partial fixes because of the numbers of errors that are out there. So you need to make a determination about that. Also, there may be bigger problems in the parish that you need to address. And in that case, you need to so to speak, save your ammo for the biggest problems, because at a certain point, you're going to get a reputation for just being a complainer and people will start tuning you out. So it's better to be a little patient and weigh in on the serious problems and not spend all your energy on the lesser ones and thus prevent yourself from being able to deal with bigger ones that may come along. So that's some general advice. In terms of participating, well, unless you're being required to say something, you don't have to participate specifically in a particular prayer. What I do when I encounter prayers that I find are imperfect, whether it's because of this issue or something else, is I'll keep my mouth shut and I'll assent in a general way to whatever is good in the prayer. And there's usually something good in there, but I don't feel any obligation to vocalize it.
Lewis, thank you so much for starting us off with that question. We have to go to a break. However, I hope that was helpful. We'll be right back with more. Jimmy Akin, Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live, right after this.
Hello, everyone. This is country music artist Colin Ray. Do what I do and keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Summer is upon us, and though the temperatures are going up, the prices are coming down during Catholic Answers' first ever summer book sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. For a limited time, dozens of great books are available for $10, $5, even as low as $1 a copy. This is the time to load up on solid Catholic books for you, your friends, and your family. The spectacular online event offers savings of 50% and more on books by Jimmy Akin, Tim Staples, Rod Bennett, Gary Machuda, and a whole host of esteemed authors, evangelists, and apologists. We've even got all of the books in our Catholic Answers Classics series marked down. Log on now to shop.catholic.com and take advantage of what will be one of the most exciting sales of the summer. You know it's all good stuff because it's from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers. Log on to shop.catholic.com and start saving today.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm really excited to tell you about a special limited-time offer we've got right now on subscriptions of our award-winning Catholic Answers magazine. Sign up today during our annual subscription drive, and not only can you save big bucks off the normal price, we'll give you a digital subscription of the magazine for free. Subscribe today by calling 818-487-2011 or by logging online to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. Sign up for a one-year subscription, and we'll give you $10 off the normal price. But better yet, become a two-year subscriber, and we'll up the ante by dropping the price by $20. That's a savings of $10 to $20 plus a free digital subscription when you sign up for Catholic Answers Magazine. Act now, because this is our best offer of the year, and it's only available for a limited time. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Magazine before our annual subscription drive ends. Phone 818-487-2011 or go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum with Jimmy Akin for 2 hours today. Can you beat that? No, you cannot beat that. And if you think you can beat it, give us a call. 888-3-2 hours
of weird questions day.
Could that beat that? That you would still be here, though.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't, because we're not doing weird questions with somebody else. Weird questions is a Jimmy Akin thing. We're not doing weird questions with Carlo. Come on.
Someday, maybe.
Yes. But you have a particular fondness for the weird, Jimmy. I think. Don't you think so?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like exploring unusual ideas.
One of the many charming things about Jimmy Akin.
Today on Facebook, Mark Shea was asking about the circumstances under which it would be appropriate to drive stakes through vampires' hearts.
See, now that should come up on the show. Mm-hmm. Why does nobody call with that question? And you're just the apologist to do it. We are joined in studio right now by Emily Sanchez. Emily's official title is Den Mother here at Catholic Answers.
That is correct.
She also bears the title Executive Assistant to the President. And why are you here, Emily?
I am here to do something very exciting, and that is unveil the Jimmy Akin M&Ms.
Oh, dun,
dun, dun. Okay, wait a second. I got to just tell people what this is all about. Jimmy Akin M&Ms are a special gift that will be given to everyone who signs up as an early bird before July 2nd for our giant conference in September.
And these were not my idea.
No.
I'm pretty sure they were.
They were not.
Jimmy came to the board. You've got to make M&Ms with me on that.
No. Chris and Erica came to me and said, "Would you object if we did this?" And I said, "Well, they're basically harmless and whimsical, so okay." But this is really weird for me to have M&Ms with my face on them.
But you like exploring unusual things.
I do.
This is
going to be an unusual thing. So if you're listening on a non-viewing device, you can check it out when you get home on Facebook or YouTube. These things are up right away after the show. But we now have the unveiling. Jimmy, you have not seen these?
Neither you or I has seen these, is my understanding.
No. And I didn't eat just in case my stomach got queasy.
Neither have I, so I'm hungry.
Well, here they are.
I don't have a drum roll for you. I'm sorry, but
so they will be, like we said, given to you if you register before early bird pricing ends, which is July 2nd, and it's worth it because this is what they look like. Here we go.
What? The Jimmy Akin M&Ms, blue, white. Are those red or orange that are in there? Oh, those
orange,
are our colors.
Colors. Those our are colors. Our colors. Blue,
yeah, the
blue,
Catholic
white,
Answers
and orange.
Cover.
There we go. So I didn't
you
know
go.
You were going to get to see
Thank
them.
Thank you.
Like, and so the Catholic.
So it says Jimmy Akin on one side and has my picture on the other.
Holy smokes.
Some of
it's
them
a
also
really good
M.
picture, too.
It's very good.
That's so amazing. Yeah. What a print job that is.
EWTN took that picture.
I hope we got the rights to it. Going to be a big battle. No. Jimmy Akin with his cowboy hat on. That is fantastic.
Oh, and some of them have the Catholic Answers logo, too.
I am torn. I could either try them now or go home and sell them on eBay. I think I could make money if I sell them on eBay. The Jimmy Akin. Let me just tell you how you get them. Let me remind you again that our big conference this year, and I think it's going to be a very big conference because the signups are going extremely well. Faith and Science, Friends or Foes, September 27th through 30th at the Hyatt Regency La Jolla here in San Diego. All of our apologists, Tim, Jimmy, Trent, Carlo, Chris Check will be speaking. Mm-hmm. Father Hugh Barber will be, along with wonderful scientists and theologians, including Stacy Trasankos, Father Terrence Ehrman, and Cardinal Raymond Burke. You just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. If you sign up before
July 2nd,
you get your own bag of Jimmy Akin M&Ms.
And they are worth it.
How do you feel, Jimmy?
This is a special moment in your life.
I feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's what I thought.
Do you have anyone you want to thank or anything? No.
I was thinking about this earlier today as I was driving and thinking about the significance of Jimmy Akin M&Ms. It's like
they have significance?
Yeah, because you go to the conference and you're equipped with all of these tools to explain and defend the faith. Mm. And in a way, you take home things with you. You take home knowledge from you. Mm-hmm. So you take home a little bit of you. Mm-hmm. And you also can be reminded that you're supposed to take things home, take you home when you have your M&Ms.
Okay.
What
cool.
A beautiful circular
deep right there.
Thought that you just had there. Yes.
Isn't that deep? Circular like the M&Ms.
I think my favorite thing about this is before you opened the box, you were like a kid at Christmas. You looked truly radiantly happy, mm-hmm. like Santa had just left you the best thing. Well, thank you for the M&Ms.
Yeah, indeed.
I'm keeping mine. You're
keep
not
them.
Getting these
keep
back,
them.
Emily.
Okay. Don't sell them on eBay, though, because
thanks very much. You
want
to say anything else
go.
About the conference before you go, Den Mother?
Oh, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be truly beautiful to see how faith and science are compatible, how they are together. They're not
separate.
That's going
to be the best part.
It's going to be a great conference.
CatholicAnswersConference.com is where you go to sign up. Thanks very much, Emily.
Thank you.
When Chris gets back, we'll tell him how awesome you have done in his absence.
Yeah.
Anonymous in Lincoln, Nebraska is next up. Anonymous, you are on with Jimmy Akin.
I had a question. I know Jimmy's a convert, and mm-hmm. I recently converted as well. And I guess my question to him is, did he have a lot of difficulty integrating into his parish community and meeting friends, you know, and getting involved in the Catholic community as a convert?
It's an interesting question. I came into the church in somewhat unusual circumstances in that when I came in, my wife was in the process of passing away. And in fact, I was received into the church in her hospital room 4 days before she died, using the emergency rite of initiation. So it was kind of a disrupted time in my life, and that obviously had an effect on the way that that I took up life as a Catholic. I was grieving during, you know, a lot of that, and so I had a kind of different path than what many people would. I did at the time, you know, I was in college, I was in grad school, and so I went to the youth group and for, you know, people of my age in the parish, the young adults group. And I had mixed success there. My approach to some questions theologically was not the same as some of the youth group leaders, and that caused some conflict. On the other hand, there were people who were really great, and so both in the young adults group and other people in the parish. And so I have a lot of fondness for those people. My life was then disrupted when within a year I moved out to California to come work for Catholic Answers. And so I made a whole new group of friends here, principally starting with people at work, but other people too. And so it just kind of happened organically. I would say in your parish, one of the things you can do is just start getting involved with different groups. There may be Bible studies. There may be – I mean, Knights of Columbus may have a chapter in your parish. I'm sure there are other groups. And just getting involved and, you know, in a setting outside of Mass but with the people from church is just naturally going to lead to conversations and friendships and things like that. And, you know, if you're someone who can be a little bit shy, like frankly I can be, there are things you can do to have icebreakers. I mean, ways of initiating conversations with people. They even have books like that. So you could always, you know, go on Amazon or something and search for books about how to start conversations with people in social settings. I don't have any of those books myself, but I know they exist. So you could check those out as a way of having something to say once you are in a social setting with other people from the parish.
Anonymous, I'm curious myself if you came from another church that felt more sociable to you. Did that happen?
I was never in any specific denomination officially, mm-hmm. but I was in a lot of different, you know, denominational, you know, conversations and things, and mm-hmm. Interact with a lot of different groups. So it was very social, a lot of young adult kind of stuff.
Uh-huh. So you kind of lost that
one community in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So you got to build it up another. And
another option, a lot of people get social interaction online these days. And so, I mean, that's what social media is for. So you might check out Catholic groups online. I know there are, you know, you might go, for example, to the Catholic Answers Facebook page. There are a lot of people there who are Catholic or who are at least Catholic friendly, who are discussing things. There are the forums at Catholic.com you could go to. So there are ways to make friends not only with fellow Catholics in your own parish, in your own area, but in far-flung parts of the world using the internet.
Okay, Anonymous?
Okay.
Thank you so much for your call. I've sometimes wondered about that, Jimmy, because, you know, Catholics, we can sometimes have the mentality of you go in almost like a service station stop. I know that not everybody does, but I often wondered how people who came from, say, a Protestant church, is there...
It depends. It depends on where they're coming from. I know some Protestants who become Catholic have too much interaction, and it's like, I'm not here to be friendly. I'm here to worship.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Fair enough. More questions for Jimmy Akin, who is a man and is now an M&M, right after this on Catholic Answers Open Forum.
I'm Jeanette DiMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
What difference does it make who or what you worship or what you believe? Sharing the faith used to make some people mad because it challenged their own strong beliefs. Today, it makes a lot of people yawn because they don't have strong beliefs about anything. Religious indifference is the great spiritual sickness of our age, a product of the relativism that dominates modern culture. This is Matt Nelson, and in my new book, Just Whatever, I'll take down the building blocks of religious indifference one by one. We'll look at the different kinds of indifference you tend to encounter in your friends and family members to see where they come from and why they're seductive. What you believe matters. Find out why and what to do about it in my new book, Just Whatever. You can order your copy of Just Whatever by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
How would you like to have the very best and faithful Catholic content delivered daily to your inbox? Articles, video, and audio, apologetics, current events, and commentary. The Catholic Answers Daily Newsletter includes all that and more, and it's easy to sign up. Just visit Catholic.com today and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front page. Keep up with what's happening in the Catholic Church with today's leading apologists, speakers, and writers delivered daily to your inbox. Catholic Answers Daily. Sign up today at Catholic.com and get better at defending your faith one day at a time.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. 2 hours of open forum today. That means if you've got a question about the Catholic faith, maybe you've got a question about Catholic history, maybe you've got a question about some particular thing that Catholics do, want to know why Catholics do that, all of that is welcome. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Jimmy Akin is our guest for both hours today, and I have to say Jimmy's very open to a broader array of questions as well. If you have a philosophical or moral or maybe a more broadly religious question, those are very, very welcome. 888-318-7884. And lest I forget to mention it, if you're not Catholic, you're welcome to call. Everyone's welcome to call. 888-318-7884. We go now to Lewis in El Paso, Texas, listening on 1150 AM, The Bridge. Lewis, you are on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, Lewis.
Nice speaking to you both.
Thank you.
Hi, my question to you is, what is the Catholic teaching on how to fight off the fear of death? You know, as one gets closer to God, it seems like worse things happen to you, and you know, fear of losing loved ones, things like that. It's something that I feel as one gets closer and, you know, prays more, it seems like the evil one tries to bring you closer to him as well. Is there a Catholic teaching or prayers one can do?
For how to deal with fear of death? Just want to make sure I understand
Correct.
The question. Okay. Well, the first thing to be aware of is that fear of death is natural. It's part of the human condition, and that's actually a gift. It's something that God built into us to help us survive. And it's something that even a perfect person would have. Jesus had it. He had death aversion, as he explained as he illustrated in the Garden of Gethsemane. Being averse to death is normal, and it's healthy, and it's part of what helps keep us alive, because if we're averse to the idea of death, we're going to do things that will help us avoid dying. We're going to take care of our health. We're going to avoid dangerous situations. We're going to eat so we don't starve. We're going to do a bunch of things. And so a certain amount of fear or aversion to death is entirely normal and to be expected and healthy. And that's the first thing I'd have to say. Having said that, it shouldn't be all-consuming, because this life is just a drop in the bucket of our existence. Death is scary, among other reasons, because we've never been on the other side of it, and so it represents an unknown to some degree. We know certain things about the afterlife, but not everything. And that unknown factor is another thing that leads to it being scary. If we don't understand something, if we don't know about something, then being confronted with it is an uncomfortable experience, because we don't know what we're supposed to do. We don't know how we're supposed to react. We don't know what's going to happen. And that sets off our danger alarms. And so because of the unknown factor, it's also scary. But one day we're going to be past it, and this life is really short. As Cardinal Newman said, life is short, eternity is long. And so even if you have 70 or 80 or 100 years here on Earth in this life, you're going to be around trillions of years from now. And from that perspective, this is just a little blip at the beginning. And so you don't need to worry about, you know, am I going to pass out of existence or something? No, the faith discloses to us that we are eternal beings in the sense that we will never pass out of existence. Now, that still leaves the question of what's our fate going to be in the afterlife? Are we going to go to the good place or the bad place? And that's something where, again, fear of death can be a helpful thing, because it'll motivate us to make sure we're right with God. But once you're right with God, you don't have to worry about death in the same way. There's still a certain natural aversion to it, but it doesn't have to be the all-consuming worry, because we know that we're not going to pass out of existence. We know God loves us, and if we're right with him, then we're going to go to the good place. And it's actually going to be way better than what we have right now. St. Paul talks about how he even in some frames of mind would like to die and go be with Christ, because it's so much better than what we have here right now. In another place, he talks about how the glories that will be revealed to us make the sufferings of this life not even worth comparing to them. That's how much better the next life is going to be than this one. And so we can look forward to those aspects of the afterlife. But ultimately, we just need to remember that God loves us and we're in his hands, and no matter what happens, whether it's life or death, if we're spiritually united with him, that's the most important thing, and he'll make sure that we're okay.
Okay, Lewis.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
No problem.
God bless you, brother. Thanks for the call. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. It is open forum, and we go now to Pete in Detroit, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Pete, you're on with Jimmy.
Hello.
Howdy.
Hi. I have a question which has been something that I've thought of for a while. I have half of a master's degree in theology from Sacred Heart Major Seminary, and this is cool. Certainly never a question that I thought of in any of my classes.
Oh, so you, after you left the seminary, you thought of the good question, and it's bugging you, huh?
Well, when I was there, I had plenty of questions, but sometimes they just come up, and I'm like, huh, I wonder about that. So here it goes.
Okay.
A little bit complicated. We know that the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit existed before time.
Mm-hmm.
They created time and space. They've always been in existence. Okay, and then at the appointed time, God decides to have Jesus come to earth and take on humanity. So now he's both human and both divine, and he's living on earth
mm-hmm.
for about 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
So my question was, how are we to think of what was happening in heaven when his humanity and divinity were on earth here, having been born through Mary? What was going on in heaven?
Oh.
Like, just to finish the question, kind of like, were the angels flying around going, boy, the place just isn't the same without Jesus around here? You kind of get my idea.
I do. Okay, Peter.
The answer to the question is that Jesus never left heaven in his divinity. As a divine person, Jesus exists or subsists in the Trinity outside of space and time. And so time does not pass there. He's eternal in the strict sense of being outside of time and immutable. And so immutable means not capable of change. And so nothing changed from that perspective in the ultimate heaven, where God is. There are different kinds of heaven, but in the ultimate heaven where God is outside of time, there is no change. And so consequently, the God the Son remained in the bosom of the Father throughout the entire time of his earthly ministry. So if it helps you to think about it this way, you could imagine sitting on the bank of a stream and putting your arm or your leg into the stream. In this analogy, the stable point where you're sitting is like the stable point, the immutable point outside of time, where Jesus is by his divine nature. And then the stream represents the flow of time. And so you can, in that way, be in two quote-unquote places at once. Heaven in this ultimate sense isn't really, it's not a physical place, but it just like you can both be sitting on the shore and have your arm or leg dangling in a stream, Jesus exists outside of time and also exists beginning at a certain point in time and then continuing forever forward, because the incarnation never ceased. Right now, he's in his physical human form is in another heaven that's at least capable of receiving objects that are extended in space and time, like his human form. But that heaven is capable of change because there was a time before he ascended into it. He's there now, and then there's going to be a time after he descends from there.
I got you.
And so we have to distinguish what type of heaven we're talking about. But in terms of the ultimate heaven, where God dwells in the full and proper sense, Jesus was and is and always will be there because it's outside of time and changeless.
I hope that helps, Peter. Thanks so much for that call. We have to take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Join us on air today on Catholic Answers Live.
Right now, Catholic Answers is conducting its summer campaign. We're going into the lean summer months, and we're forecasting a shortfall of $220,000 before our income picks up again later in the year. This is a crucial time because we need to offset that drop in donations. To make your donation and get your special thank you gifts, visit Catholic.com and click the summer campaign banner. Or call us toll free at 888-291-8000. That's the summer campaign banner at Catholic.com or call toll free 888-291-8000.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Open Forum today. Jimmy Akin here with us for both hours, and your calls are welcome. 888-318-7884, the number. Next up, Martina in Missouri, listening on 89.4 FM. And Martina, you are on with Jimmy Akin.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
My question is, I've heard a lot of things about offering suffering to the Lord, whether you stub your toe or if you're suffering something serious, to offer up your suffering, and I don't know what that's about.
Okay. This is a common piece of advice that, like, Catholic parents give children who are suffering, and it can occur in other contexts as well. It can mean different things, but the basic meaning is you're asking God to take your suffering as an occasion to produce some good. And actually, we know that that's going to happen anyway. As the Catechism says, God wouldn't even allow an evil to occur, suffering being a form of evil. He wouldn't even allow an evil to occur if he didn't have a way to bring good out of it. So ultimately, all the suffering we experience will bring about some good. But when we talk about offering our suffering up, it's a way of voluntarily participating in that. And it can take a number of different forms. Usually, it will mean asking God for some blessing in particular, like, Lord, if you like the way I'm handling this suffering and how I'm trying to accept it serenely, then please help me grow in holiness, or help some other person with something they need. Or it could even be more general of, Lord, I don't know what I should ask for here, but I just want to present you with my circumstance and the suffering it involves, and I want to please you in how I deal with this suffering, and, you know, please bring about some good as a result of that. If I am pleasing you, please reward that by accomplishing something, whether it's something I learn about in this life or something I never learn about in this life. I just want to please you in how I'm doing this, and I ask you to bless me or others or the world.
Martina, does that work for you?
Well, would you be able to offer any suffering that you're having for people in purgatory? Would that
sure.
be something that's okay?
Yep. You can totally do that. You can offer it for any good intention, including helping people in purgatory.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Martina. Appreciate that. Let's go to David in Santa Cruz watching on YouTube. Thanks for watching on YouTube, David. Your question for Jimmy?
Yeah, just in regard. Oh, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
This is in regard to original sin. And so just the difference between how Protestants look at original sin and how Catholics do. Now, do Catholics, they don't see it as personal guilt, and Protestants do? That's my main question.
Okay. Well, there's a range of views of original sin on both sides of the confessional divide. There are certain basic points, and different Catholic theologians have different ways of articulating the doctrine of original sin, but there are certain basic points that are part of church teaching. And one of them is that original sin does not produce guilt in us in the proper sense, because you can only be guilty of something that you did. And we did not commit original sin. Our first parents did. And so the personal guilt applied to them, but we experienced the consequences of their act. And that's, you know, similar to other ways in which the bad actions of parents can affect their children and other descendants. You know, if you're Homer Simpson and you're playing with green radioactive rods in the opening credits of your show that really should be blue in the real world, and you damage your genes, well, then your kids are and your other descendants are going to suffer the consequences of that. And so by original sin, we ended up inheriting, in the Catholic view, two things. One is a deprivation of sanctifying grace. That means we're deprived of the original holiness that God willed for us to have. So we're born deprived of that. We need it, but we don't have it. Secondly, we are born with a fallen nature that has a variety of consequences. Principally among them, one of the principal ones, is we have temptations to sin. We have disordered desires that personally can lead us into sin. And so those two things are what we do have, and those are settled parts of Catholic teaching. In terms of Protestant belief, it's going to depend really on who you're talking to in the Protestant community, because there's a wide range of opinion. There are some groups of Protestants that outright deny original sin, that effectively are Pelagian in terms of their outlook on these things. Others go to another extreme and will say, not only do we have a fallen nature as a result of original sin, but we also are held personally guilty by God such that he could send us to roast in hell even if we did nothing else just because of original sin. And that's a position that is not held by the Catholic Church. But in terms of the Protestant view, it really is going to depend on which group of Protestants you're talking about.
Okay.
Just a quick follow-up question.
Go ahead, David.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. So in a Protestant view, or the one you just described, the more Calvinistic it sounds like,
yeah,
they would believe that your very nature would incur guilt, but Catholicism would say your nature itself does not constitute actual guilt.
It depends on what you mean by nature. If you just mean the fact you're a human descended from Adam, then yeah, they would say your nature is, as a human descended from Adam, is what's going to result in divine punishment if nothing happens about it. That's not the same thing as saying just the fact that you have a fallen, broken nature is what causes it. They would say this is a legal matter, and God, in this view, can legally punish you because of what Adam did as the federal head of and thus the legal representative of the entire race.
Okay, David, thank you so much. I'm going to move. I want to try to get somebody another, at least one more call in before we have to get to the top of the hour. We go to Lydia in Chicago watching on YouTube. Lydia, thanks for watching on YouTube. Your question for Jimmy? Hi, Lydia.
Hi. So my question is, it's kind of similar to the whole offering it up, but I was having a conversation with a Protestant friend just last night, and I grew up with a mother that threw that phrase everywhere. So that is kind of familiar to me. It was sparked by a conversation about the soul of the apostolate in one of the chapters that talks about the levels of holiness and how there's this desire for suffering. And, you know, I shared that with her, and she's like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would God want us to suffer?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is that even? And I threw out, you know, uniting it to the cross. She's like, that doesn't make any sense. And she probably was thinking, like, that's blasphemy. But I was wondering if Jimmy, especially as a former Protestant, if you could shed some light on just how to better explain how suffering can be redemptive.
Okay.
When speaking to Protestant brothers and sisters.
Okay. So I assume you're talking about The Soul of the Apostolate by Jean-Baptiste Chatard?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I would say a few things in terms of how to explain this to Protestants. One is I don't know that I would be quoting books from Catholic spiritual authors that are really coming from a different mental place than the Protestant is, because there's a native instinct that people are going to have to say, Jean-Baptiste Chatard is not one of my people, so I'm automatically going to be suspicious of what he has to say. Instead, I would go to the mental world that your Protestant friend is familiar with, the Bible. And I would say, look, in the Bible, the central event of the New Testament is the crucifixion of Jesus. That involved huge suffering, but God used it to bring about the greatest good in the world, namely the salvation of all mankind, at least those who are willing to accept it. And so this shows us that God can use suffering to bring about good. Does that apply only to Jesus? Well, not according to other passages in the New Testament. If you look, for example, in St. Paul's writings, he talks about how through his ministry, you know, he faced a lot of hardship and trials in his ministry, and he talks about how in these sufferings he fills up what's lacking in the sufferings of Christ. Now, that statement of itself is something that can put people a little bit on the defensive because, I mean, what does he mean something's lacking in the sufferings of Christ? They're of infinite value. So, and St. Paul knew that. So he didn't think that there was literally something lacking in Christ's sufferings. But this does illustrate Paul saying, I fill up in my own body what's lacking in the sufferings of Christ for the sake of the church. It shows us that God can enter into our sufferings like those of St. Paul and bring about good for the church, for other people. And then if we look at other passages in the New Testament, like in the book of Acts, it talks about how at one point some of the apostles have been arrested and beaten by the authorities in Jerusalem, and they rejoice afterwards because they had been counted worthy to suffer for Christ. And so and there are various exhortations in the New Testament to rejoice when we suffer because of these good things that it signifies. It can bring about good for others. It can be a sign that we're spiritually where we need to be and we have a great destiny ahead of us in heaven. And so I would point out biblical passages like these as a way of helping these thoughts become more intelligible to your friend.
Lydia, thanks so much for that. I'm going to move to one more question before we get to the top of the hour. We go to Mary in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, who was watching on Facebook. Mary, your question for Jimmy, and kind of make it quick so you have time to answer it. Mary, okay?
Okay. Jimmy, real quickly, you said Jesus is in an alternate heaven right now. Could you please explain that? Are there multiple heavens, or
okay,
what did you mean?
The idea that there, and what I said was that Jesus is in more than one heaven right now. He's in the ultimate heaven outside of time, and he's in another one that's at least capable of receiving physical bodies like the one he took with him at the ascension. But yes, there are multiple heavens. This is something that is referred to in the Bible. St. Paul at one point, for example, mentions being caught up to third heaven. And it's not entirely clear how many heavens there are. One way that the Bible uses heaven is to refer to the atmosphere. So you have the clouds of heaven, or the birds of heaven. Another way is it refers to what today we would call outer space, where you have the stars of heaven. It also refers to the place where God dwells, and actually God dwells in multiple senses in different heavens. According to some accounts in Judaism and Christianity, there are seven or more heavens. And a first century Christian book, it's not in the New Testament, but it's called The Ascension of Isaiah, actually involves an imaginative journey up through all the seven heavens and back down again.
Mary, thanks for making that question so quick and giving Jimmy a chance to answer it. We're going to take a quick break, but we got another hour in store of open forum for you. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't dialed yet, you're welcome to dial 888-318-7884. It'll be Jimmy Akin taking those questions again next hour. If you have any question on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, all are welcome. 888-31-TRUTH. Right back after this.